first in this year's Research Group on Constitutional Studies lecture series. I'm Jacob Levy, the coordinator of RGCS. The Research Group on Constitutional Studies brings together McGill's research communities around the constitutional foundations and orderings of political societies, and thereby brings together political theory, political philosophy, jurisprudence, and law in shared intellectual conversations. The lecture series began last year as a way to try to bring those concerns of the RGCS into especially active undergraduate and student intellectual life, aiming to bring in serious and first-rate scholars and researchers to give us the results and the inquiries of their research into the foundations, principles, and institutions of a free society. The lecture series aims to make live for student audiences some of what happens in leading research in political theory and political philosophy. The lecture series is supported by a generous gift to McGill from the Oria Foundation, for which we are grateful. I'll begin by mentioning the upcoming events of the lecture series before turning to today's. On November 14th, in Lee Talk 232, we will be joined by Naomi Lamoureux, Professor of Economics and History at Yale University, for a lecture on civil society and organizational history. January 9th, Ilya Soman, Professor of Law at George Mason, will give a lecture on democracy and political ignorance. And April 3rd, the year will conclude with a debate between Chandran Kukathas from Politics at the London School of Economics and Kip Wellman from Philosophy at Washington University of St. Louis, debating open borders and immigration. And that will be in this room on that day. I'm expecting there to be at least one more event in that schedule, but it is not quite finalized yet. We also have some smaller events from time to time. The next smaller event open to a general student audience will be November 1st. Stephen Horowitz, economist at St. Louis University, will be giving a seminar on capitalism and the family. To begin our lecture series for this year, we are delighted and honored to be joined by Gerald Gass, one of the leading political philosophers at work in the field today. Professor Gass trained in and has served in several of the disciplines that RGCS represents, with backgrounds in political science and philosophy, and now acting among his other tasks as the head of a program in politics, philosophy, economics, and law at the University of Arizona, where he is James E. Rogers Professor of Philosophy. Professor Gass is a founding co-editor of the journal Politics, Philosophy, and Economics, and is the author of numerous important books, including, I think most prominently, Justificatory Liberalism, Value and Justifications, the Foundations of Liberal Theory, and the magisterial recent The Order of Public Reason, a Theory of Freedom and Morality in a Diverse and Bounded World. He is additionally the author of dozens of articles in leading journals and venues in political philosophy. When at one point I had occasion to do a survey of the 50 years of contents of the yearbook Nomos, I found that Professor Gass was the most published author in Nomos' history. Professor Gass' main area of work is on public reason. The Order of Public Reason argues that respect for all as free and equal moral persons requires that our social morality be publicly justified. However, the project of identifying such a morality is indeterminate. Drawing on ideas in game theory and social evolution, Gass tries to show how respect for the moral freedom of all is still possible in the face of this indeterminacy. He is also the winner of the Kafka Prize for the best published paper in political philosophy, for a paper in 2009 titled On Justifying the Moral Rights of the Moderns, a Case of Old Wine in New Bottles. please join me in welcoming in his first trip to Montreal and to McGill, Professor Gerald Gass.
Thank you very much. I'm delighted to be in Montreal. I always feel very intimidated in multilingual countries and cities. I grew up in Buffalo, and most of us didn't learn English. So that someone learned more than one language is quite impressive for someone from Buffalo. What I want to do today is tell a story about a certain way of thinking about the problem of modernity, people who have defended it this way, and problems with it. It's a theory about liberalism. Liberalism is in the name of my talk. I want to distinguish, to begin with, two very, very broad understandings of how we might justify liberalism. And I want to use liberalism in a very broad way. I simply mean today, and it's good enough, a stable and fair framework of tolerance so that diverse people can live together. If that means we're all liberals, I'm very happy about that. So I'm interested in how we justify a tolerant society. And in the liberal tradition, there's been at least two ways in which people have tried to do this. One is to say that there's a moral law, or the moral truth, or moral rights, and the true moral rights and the correct moral law dictate tolerance. I see this as a somewhat sectarian understanding of liberalism, because as I understand it, and I'll talk about today, what modernity is about is that we disagree about the true moral rights, and we disagree about the moral law, and we disagree about God's will. And if liberalism depends on a particular version of that, then rather than trying to be a solution to our problem of disagreement, it's one of the contestants in it. Many people find this version of liberalism persuasive and important, and I'm not going to argue against it today. I'm setting it aside for a different tradition. And this tradition sees the fundamental problem of liberalism one of rational disagreement. When people of goodwill apply their reason to questions of God's will, but also of our place in the universe, the meaning of life, what morality really is, and all these matters, good-willed people, thinking through things as best they can, come to deeply different answers. And for this version of liberalism, which I call public reason liberalism, this is the beginning point of analysis. How can we solve this problem? I believe this is a compelling view because it doesn't try to solve modernity by adding to the problem of one more view of truth, but tries to solve the really deep problem of modern life by analyzing how we can overcome it. Today's talk is in four acts. The first act is my Hobbesian act. I'm going to suggest that Thomas Hobbes, writing in the 17th century, saw the problem of modernity clearly than anyone else had, and also shows why the liberal solution can't possibly work. So Hobbes, I believe, provides the challenge to all subsequent public reason theorists saying what you want to do just can't possibly work. The second act is Locke. I bring Locke in as giving the quintessential but, in the end, unconvincing reply to Hobbes's critique of the liberal project. Act three is a two-part act. It's the act with John Rawls. Being a political theorist and not a historian, I can zip 300 years from my third act. What happens in between is not that much interest to me. And Rawls, I want to say, in the first part of act three, provides the definitive and most sophisticated solution to the problems that Locke left us. It's in some way the complete and ultimate statement of public reason liberalism. The second part of Act 3 is Rawls saying it doesn't work. That one of the really remarkable things about Rawls is he's the critic of his own project, where his students were willing to let the project roll. Rawls said, no, it was a nice idea, it was one of my most innovative ideas, but unfortunately it fails. And Rawls tries at the end to reimagine in a really radical way how we might go about this project. Act 4 is my unfinished act, in which contemporary proponents of this project have split into two very different directions. And what direction we should go in is something that we can talk about. So those are my four acts. So on to the Hobbesian act. On my view, Hobbes' really important contribution to political philosophy usually hasn't been fully understood. We all know, which is partially correct, the view that Hobbes is a theorist of self-interest, a theorist of egoism. In my high school class, we learned that Hobbes thought people were selfish, Rousseau thought people were good, and Locke didn't have an opinion either way because we were blank slates, right? And that was our political philosophy in Buffalo. And it has some elements of truth in it, but I think there's a deeper truth, and that Hobbes had most sophisticated analysis of the fundamental fact that when we reason, our very use of reason leads us to disagree. It's not pride, it's not sin, it's not ignorance, it's the use of our reason is the source of disagreement. And that's at one on the handout. I won't read many of these quotes, or not all, but this is an important one. This occurs early on in Leviathan. Hobbes says, reason itself is always right reason, as well as arithmetic is a certain and infallible art. But no man's reason, nor the reason of any number of men, makes for certainty. And therefore, as when there is a controversy in account, the parties must by their own accord set up for right reason, the reason of some arbiter or judge to whose sentence they both will stand. Or the controversy must either come to blows or be undecided for want of a right reason constituted by nature. So is it also in all debates of what kind soever. This is theoretical, practical, political. And when men think themselves wiser than all others and clamor and demand that right reason be the judge, yet seek no more than things should be determined by their own, by no man's reason but their own, it is intolerable in the society of men. For they do nothing else than they'll have every one of their passions as it comes to bear sway on them be taken for right reason, and that in their own controversies, betraying their want of right reason by the claim they laid to it. We all agree we should do the rational thing. Right reason is the rational thing. Our disputes are about what is the rational thing. Someone who seeks to solve the dispute by saying, yes, we should do the rational thing. It's what I think is the rational thing. Hobbes says, by the very claim they lay to right reason, don't show that they don't have it, for they fail to see that our dispute is about who has right reason. And simply asserting their claim to right reason is not a way of solving the dispute. It constitutes the dispute. And indeed, Hobbes says that anyone who takes that attitude, their existence is intolerable in the society of men, for they insist that all be guided by their reason, when our fundamental problem is that we disagree about whose reason is correct. Hobbes makes the problem worse. Not only does the use of our reason lead us to disagree, and on all matters. This quote, this passage from Hobbes is not from a political passage, it's a passage about the use of reason. It applies to arithmetic, it applies to geometry, it applies to politics. About everything, our reason leads us to disagree. And secondly, Hobbes says, and no rules could ever solve this problem. We might try to set up a system of rules to say, well, if we follow these rules, then our disagreements about reason can be adjudicated. But Hobbes says, but we need reason to interpret the rules. So we're back to the same problem. So Hobbes says it too. All laws, written and unwritten, have need of interpretation. The unwritten law of nature, though it be easy to such as without partiality and passion to make use of for their natural reason, and therefore leaves violators without excuse, yet considering there be very few, perhaps none, that in some cases are not blinded by self-love or some other passion, it has now become of all laws the most obscure, and has consequently the greatest need of able interpreters. So we know that any dispute can be a dispute where our right reason leads us to disagree. We also know that there's no way to have a system of rules to avoid this dispute. So what Hobbes says is the only way for us to live together is in some way to make someone's reason the public reason. And Hobbes is particularly convinced there's no way to insulate the disputes of one field from another. We can't say, let people reason well when it comes to politics, and they can reason on their own. In politics, we can reason together according to settled rules, but in religion, you can go any way you want. That is the basic idea of a public-private divide. Hobbes says it's impossible, because our private disputes will always flow into public disputes. There's no way to insulate. Hobbes, I think, was particularly impressed by the experience in the first years of Cromwell's Commonwealth, where there was freedom of thought and of religious interpretation. What was found, and this was important for the later Tory Restorationists, is that any freedom in one area led to amazing doctrines in another. So the freedom to interpret the scriptures led to political doctrines like the Quakers, the Ranters, and the Shakers. My favorite doctrine was the Fifth Monarchy men, who arose during this time. And on their interpretation, basis of their interpretation of Daniel's dream, concluded there could only be five legitimate monarchies in the history of humans. The fourth was the Roman Empire, and the fifth was the reign of Christ. Therefore, there was no legitimate government until Christ returned to earth. This was a significant political consequence that immediately rose from religious freedom. So Hobbes says, there's no way to say be free in one area, but we have to agree in another area, for any freedom in one area is going to lead right to disagreement in another. So what do we need? Hobbes has this analysis, and the solution is that we need someone to regulate all opinions. Because, as Hobbes says at 3 on the handout, for the actions of men proceed from their opinions, and in the well-governing of opinions consists the well-governing of actions in order to their peace and concord. It's reason that leads us to disagree. We act on our beliefs. Therefore, we have to regulate what people believe. Hobbes' understanding of freedom of religion is restricted to one case. You can believe anything you want. And why? Because you can't control what you believe. And since you can't control what you believe, the sovereign can't command it. Inside, since belief is not voluntary, therefore it can't be commanded. But the wagging of the tongue, that's an act. So the sovereign can command you not to talk about it, not to tell anyone else about it, how to act. Anything that doesn't involve belief itself is under the authority of the sovereign. How much is under the authority of the sovereign? We can see at 4 on the handout. We are not everyone to make our own private reason or conscience, but the public reason, that is the reason of God's supreme lieutenant, that is the sovereign, judge of controversies. When it comes to confession of faith, the private reason must submit to the public. Confession is an act. It's a wagging of the tongue, and therefore any confession has to obey what the sovereign commands. The sovereign is judge of what is necessary for peace. We all know that. But he's the judge of doctrines. He's the sole legislature. He is the supreme judge of all controversies. Hobbes sees the problem of modern life. Reason leads us to disagree. Disagreement in one area can cascade into disagreement anywhere. There's no rules that we can use to sort this out because they're just one more source of disagreement. So how, given this problem, are we to live peacefully? We must submit to the reason of one person and take that person's reason as right reason. Not because it is, but because we need to agree on what reason is. Our natural reason won't do that, so we institute a sovereign who is an artificial reasoner who we submit to. In many ways, I think Hobbes then supplies what I want to call something like an impossibility theorem of liberalism as a response to this problem, that somehow you can bootstrap liberalism out of the fact of disagreement. And I give Hobbes' impossibility theorem, an informal one, at 5 on the handout. 4 key claims. The ubiquity of disagreement. Our reasoning leads to disagreement in everything. For any type of doctrine, principle, law, or rule, there'll be divergent interpretations of a private reason. Secondly, these disagreements are not bounded within some range in which all people agree. It can go anywhere. The Fifth Monarchy men are anarchists, essentially. Non-insulation. There's no way to insulate disputes in one area from other aspects of social and political life. Religious differences lead to political differences. Moral differences lead to political differences. Metaphysical differences lead to political differences. And lastly, unlimited procedural authority. Because of A and B, no set of impartial substantive rules can effectively order social life. We have to appeal to a judge or an umpire or some procedure to determine right reason. And D, the unlimited procedural authority, given A, B, C, only if each submits her private judgment to the public judgment on all matters on which the sovereign decides to issue a judgment, can the public order be secured. So we have an analysis of the ubiquity of disagreement and an argument that only a sort of public reason authoritarianism can possibly solve the problem. So at the end of Act 1, Hobbes has laid down the challenge to all thinkers who take the fact of rational disagreement seriously, only authoritarian solutions are possible. Enter Locke, Act 2. The canon often depicts Locke and Hobbes as simply protagonists. And indeed, in many ways, they are protagonists. But there's also important ways in which they share the same analysis of modern life. They share, for example, the belief that we will not agree on the moral law, that when we use our reason about what the moral law is, we will disagree about it. At 6a on the handout, there's a quote from Locke, which is extraordinarily like what Hobbes says at 2 on the handout. Locke says, though the law of nature be plain and intelligible to all rational creatures, yet men being biased by their interest, as well as ignorant for want of studying it, are not apt to allow it as a law binding on them in the application of it to their particular cases. It should be clear, but because our interpretation are biased, we disagree about what the law of nature is. And interestingly, and this is something which very few people seem to appreciate, one of the elements of the Lockean social contract is that people abandon their private judgment about morality, at least within a huge range, and submit to the public judgment of the sovereign as to what morality is. So as Locke says at 6b, and this is part of what's required for the social contract, all private judgment of every particular member being excluded, and that's private judgment about the law of nature, the community comes to be umpired by settled and standing rules indifferent and the same to all parties. Locke also agrees that we disagree about morality and no set of rules is going to solve that problem. In fact, if we're going to live together, we have to agree not to follow our own private judgment about morality, but submit to a public reason about morality. So it looks that not only does Locke share Hobbes' belief that we disagree about morality, but he agrees that we have to, in some sense, alienate our private judgment about morality when we come into civil society. So given all this, how does Locke avoid the Hobbesian authoritarianism? What Locke does at this point is he gives us two claims that are going to be central to people think about this problem for the rest of the history of liberalism. And the first one is the shared reasons claim, that there's a set of reasons that, despite all of our disagreement, we do share. And these are what Locke calls the civil interests. At 7 on the handout, Locke says, the commonwealth seems to me to be a society of men constituted only for the procuring, preserving, and advancing of their own civil interests. Civil interests I call life, liberty, health, and indolency of body, and the possession of outward things, such as money, lands, houses, furniture, and the like. So this is sort of pedestrian, important interests that we all can see, that aren't sort of metaphysically determined, but we all sort of can understand what they are. And we can see that politics should be about this. So there's two levels of the shared interest. There's the specific ones that the pedestrian interests we all share, and there's the belief that politics is about these. We share that too. So we share a conception of politics, and we share that it's about these civil things. That's the first element of the Lockean liberal reply. There's an importance that although we disagree, there's things we share. But remember, Hobbes said, look, even if we agree in one area, disagreement in one area cascades and into the other areas. And so any agreement we might get for a while in politics, religious disagreement will cascade and take care of it. So Locke introduces the claim that I talked about, the title of this paper, the insulation claim, that we can insulate these shared interests from our wider disagreement. As Locke says at 8 on the handout, I esteem it above all things necessary to distinguish exactly the business of civil government from that of religion, and to settle the just bounds that lie between the one and the other. If this not be done, there can be no end put to the controversies that will always be arising between those who have, or at least pretend to have, on the one side a concern for the interest of men's souls, on the other side a care for the commonwealth. Unless we get the public-private boundary down, we can't even begin to have an agreed-upon politics, because people who are talking about our souls will start to talk about our interests. Now, Locke, especially in the letters on toleration, does make attempts to justify some aspects of this insulation claim, which I think is fundamental to many liberalisms, and which I'm going to suggest is very hard to maintain. But how does Locke try to do it? He does argue that, you know, most Protestant doctrines can accept seeing churches as voluntary, non-political organizations. So this is something which coheres with their way of thinking about the world. So it's not like it's totally alien to many Protestant doctrines. So there's some uptake that we should expect Protestants to have with this insulation view, that politics and course of life is about the civil interests. But Locke gets into lots of trouble trying to defend the insulation claim. And I think the two best examples are his two most famous exceptions to toleration. One exception to toleration are the Roman Catholics. We should tolerate everybody but not those Catholics, and that's because Catholics can't accept insulation. Locke says, you know, Catholics believe the Pope can excommunicate a monarch, but an excommunicated monarch is not owed obedience, so the Catholics do not have a religious view which insulates their religious belief from politics. And without that insulation, they can't be part of the liberal settlement. So at this point, rather than arguing that, look, insulation is part of the way we see the world, so liberalism is stable, it looks like Locke is saying, if you insulate the world, you can be a liberal, which I'm going to suggest are two very different ways of going. That is, the admission ticket for the liberal settlement requires you to buy insulation. If you can say, yes, I can insulate, liberals say, come in. If you say, no, I can't insulate because, after all, the politics that I can endorse has something to do with whether my soul will be saved, then the liberals have to say, sorry, you can't be admitted into the liberal church. But then Locke himself, after sort of stating this, then calls insulation into question in his second great exception, the atheist. Why can't the atheist be tolerated? Because we can't believe anything he says, and why can't we believe anything he says? Because he doesn't have religious beliefs. Locke explicitly says in this point, you know, morality, it bridges the secular and the religious. But now, if morality bridges the two, it's neither simply religious or simply secular, and if no one can participate in the liberal settlement without being moral, then they can't fully insulate their beliefs. I mean, there's some sense in which the atheist is the perfect insulator. Having no religious belief, he has no problem insulating them. But that won't do for Locke, because morality draws on religion, and the atheist doesn't have a religion, so he can't be moral. So then at the end, it's not clear what Locke himself thinks of the insulation thesis. It looks more and more like a doctrine for particular Protestants, rather than sort of a general analysis. Let me sort of sum up the Locke liberal resolution, which I think Rawls is going to try to defend. It has three steps. First is A, moral disagreement claim, and that's simply part, I think, of all public reason views, whether you're liberal or non-liberal. When individuals reason about the requirements of morality and justice, for Locke and Hobbes, the law of nature, they disagree. So peace and cooperative social political life requires that, within limits, they abandon their private judgment about morality and justice and submit to the public reason of impartial law. The shared reasons claim is the basis of civil societies, our shared reasons to advance our common civil interests. The resolution of our moral disagreement is one of those fundamental shared civil and political interests. And the insulation claim is that private judgment about religious matters can remain free and private. These deep and enduring conflicts do not infect, and so, in so doing, unravel our concurrence on the moral disagreement and shared reasons claim. So, A is a sort of general feature of public reason views, and B and C are the Locke's two ways of trying to resist the Hobbesian critique or the Hobbesian impossibility theorem. But as I said, it's at best an incomplete defense of insulation, and perhaps an inadequate one. Okay. So closes Act Two. We have the Hobbesian challenge. We have the attempt at the Lockean reply. I think Locke puts down the two principles that liberals are going to defend, but it's not clear whether he gives an adequate defense, especially of the core insulation claim. Act Three comes Rawls in 1971. Now, one of the ironies, I think, of Rawls's book is it's popular mainly because people refuse to read it as he wrote it. He wrote it very worried about the Hobbesian worry. In Rawls's understanding of an adequate political philosophy, whatever results you come to has to have a good answer to someone who says, yeah, but when I know everything I know about my personal and metaphysical and religious beliefs, I can't possibly go along with this. Rawls spent a third of his book trying to answer this question. It was the third of the book that many scholars didn't read and almost all told their students not to read because they couldn't see what was going on in it. Because they want to interpret Rawls as a sectarian liberal giving a true theory of justice. If he was a sectarian liberal giving a true theory of justice, as soon as he told us what justice was, it was over because he told us what the truth is. But not being a sectarian liberal telling us what the true theory of justice was, he says explicitly people choosing justice then have to say, will this be stable when people know everything about themselves? And so I want to sort of give the view, which I think Rawls had in mind. As I said, for one thing, he thinks that the part everyone doesn't read was his most inventive contribution to political philosophy. So here's our problem. And let me explain, let me give a little view of Rawls, taking account of my explication of Locke. I want to suggest that Rawls divides us, try to write big on this. This is a simple diagram, no indifference curves here. We just got A, B, and C, so this will be easy. A is our set of shared interests. And this is the argument from the original position. In the famous argument from the original position, Rawls says, imagine a group of people who only know the things they all care about, their primary goods, that is, liberty, wealth, income, opportunities, a version of Lockean civil interests, that things that everyone agrees, really pedestrian, we all need to live. And imagine a group of people who only know these things about themselves. That is, they're restricted to only knowledge of their shared interests, and they know nothing about their particular identity or the identity of their society, then what will these people accept? And we get the derivation that these will be the principles that they will use to adjudicate their claims about shared interests. How much liberty I should have. How much opportunity I should have. How much wealth I should have. We all agree about these things, but we have different claims. So if we only knew we cared about these things and we didn't know special facts, what would we agree to? We get an answer based on shared interest, we get certain principles. Now, as I said, most people there, many, many, many readers just stop there thinking, well, Rawls is done. Interestingly, though, Rawls says explicitly, even people in the original position aren't done. He says now they have to think about something else. What they have to think about, and Rawls says this is supposed to be in the original position, whether people who actually know what they really care about, set C, the diverse metaphysical interests or religious interests, whether these people will actually still accept these principles. Rawls says, this is just an abstract, small set of interests. What if you found, yeah, I would agree to these principles if I only knew I cared about primary goods, but then you find out something about what you think the meaning of life is or what God's will is. Rawls says, could it be the case that obeying these principles could turn you against what you think God's will is? Then at best, liberalism would demand a schizophrenic self, would demand that the self not be unified. On the one hand, God says, I'll be damned for doing this. On the other hand, it's just. Right? Rawls says that could be. But we can't expect a stable system of free cooperation to exist if people are torn that way. So Rawls says, after getting this answer, now we have to see whether the disagreements in C, that is, religious differences in understanding of metaphysics and ethics and virtue, will these overwhelm our agreement in A, such that people say, no, I can't possibly live according to these principles? This is taking seriously Hobbes's argument that the disagreements in one area will affect another. And Rawls spends, as I said, hundreds of pages trying to solve this problem. Now, how he solves it, I think, is it's innovative, and it's by far the most sophisticated defense of the insulation problem. I call it on, in the notes, the double shared strategy on the handout at 10. He says, well, let's put in between A and B, A and C, something else. And this he calls the thin theory of the good, which is not that thin. The thin theory of the good are general features of all rational and good plans of life. They are things like all people, regardless of C, would value friendship. All rational people, regardless of C, value love. All people, regardless of C, would like to develop their capacities. All people would like to develop their capacities in a society where other people develop different capacities and they can appreciate them, where one person's nature completes the nature of others. And all people would like to express their nature as free and equal rational beings. All of that, Rawls says, we agree upon too. Now Rawls says, look, A and B have a congruence relation. B, he shows at great length, endorses the conclusions of A. That is, we arrived at A by a very austere argument based just on Lockean shared values about the political. But then we solve the Hobbesian worry by saying, but the thin theory of the good is not about the political, it's about what a good planet, what a good life is. And once we consider A and B, we see we have very firm reason to not only act justly, but see that justice never makes a sacrifice our good. We can think of B as a firewall between C and A. You know, we still have disagreements. We still have religious disagreements. Rawls doesn't say that B is all there is. But B is important structural and substantive elements of the good life that all rational people have. This rational and substantive notion of the good life strongly supports acting on the principles of justice. Therefore, the principles of justice does not turn us against our good, rather they affirm our good in a very strong way. So that in the end, given the importance of B and B supporting A, we can be confident that justice doesn't require us to turn our back on C or that any disagreements on C will be outweighed by the tremendous agreement of B and A together. So these group together are so strong that we can be sure that the remaining disagreements in C will not wash over and undermine the liberal project. Understood like that, which I think is the way Rawls wanted to, we can see why he spends so much time on B. I mean, many people said, why do you care about B? You've already derived the principles of justice. But if you're a public reason theorist, that's the easy part. The easy part is to show that the disagreement isn't going to unravel all the hard work you've done. Locke had his insulation claim, but he doesn't really show that insulation is going to work. Rawls spends a great deal of time showing it's going to work by the thin theory of the good, which turns out to be a fairly important, robust theory of the good. Interestingly, Hegelian, that one person's nature completes the nature of others, and so we have complementary natures. And that's the problem. It turns out to be a rather strong thin theory of the good. So that's part one of Act Three. That is, we had the Hobbesian challenge. Locke sketches out what you need to do to reply, but it's not clear that Locke actually can do it. Rawls comes along and provides a long and sophisticated argument showing if all this was true, then we can insulate. Why will we insulate? Because B is just going to protect A. So why can't public reason liberals say, well, we have the apex of public reason thinking, and we should stop? And that's because of part two of Act Three, where Rawls says, yeah, but this doesn't work. Right? Interestingly, none of his students said it because they didn't really worry about it, right? I mean, the students are just what justice is, right? And Rawls is thinking, yeah, but is this a plausible picture? And Rawls determines, that's not a plausible picture. I think we can see two ways it's not a plausible picture. One is after all this talk about disagreement, it pushes disagreement off to the periphery. It turns out that liberal can insulate their principles from disagreement, because we don't disagree about all that much. I mean, we not only agree about justice, we agree about the good life. So it turns out that C is for a peripheral worry. And indeed, religious questions and deep metaphysical questions really are not very important in a theory of justice. It's really pushed off to the periphery. So the first thing you might say is it solves the question by trivializing it. And Rawls, I think, suggests that he might have done so, because the words he uses in his later book are not that we disagree, but we have intractable disputes of absolute depth about these matters, right? I mean, these are just things that we just can't come to terms with about religious matters and metaphysical matters. So one is that C is much more important than he thought it was. B is much more controversial than he originally thought it was. So first of all, C is pushed off to the periphery, and it doesn't look like that everyone agrees on things like the important good of expressing your nature as a free and equal moral being, or that we all believe that society is a way in which one person completes the nature of others. Another way of seeing the problem is that the Hobbesian problem is just going to reappear. Why is B insulated from C? C is my religion. B is my vision of the good life. Why should I think my vision of the good life is going to be insulated from my understanding of God's will? C is my metaphysics and my meta-ethics. Why should I think that those are going to be insulated from my notion of the good life? Rawls solved this insulation problem by sort of assuming another one. But Rawls ends up saying that's not going to work for lots of these reasons. So, you know, I think in one of the unacknowledged but really impressive feats of intellectual integrity, rather than sort of riding with the picture that everyone was praising, he said the picture's all wrong, and we have to get it all going all over again. So what Rawls does is something really audacious. He keeps A, although we're going to say maybe not, he keeps A, our shared reasons. Right? He keeps C, that is our deep and intractable conflicts about important issues of metaphysics and the meaning of life. B goes. B's dropped. In fact, for those of you who like Rawls Judean, a lot of the elements of B gravitate into A, and so A gets a little bit sort of pumped up by anything he thinks he could say from B, turns up to be pumped into A in order to make A stronger on its own than it used to be. But, you know, without worrying about things gravitating and stuff, basically the simple story is that A stays, B pretty much goes, some of it's pumped into A, so it's like super A to some extent, and C remains. But then it seems like we're back to the Hobbes' problem. Okay, the firewall's gone, so why doesn't A catch fire? And so here's Rawls' really audacious move, saying, you know what? Everyone's thought that C's the problem. No, C's the answer. Right? C supports A. Here, imagine this. Imagine an overlapping consensus, which I sort of give a little sketch of it. 11 on the handout for those of you who are acquainted with the idea. Imagine that, first of all, we agree on A, and then once we think about C, we're still on board with A. So rather than thinking from Locke to early Rawls about how to insulate the liberal answer from the disagreement, can we draw on the disagreement to support the liberal answer? Right? And in fact, Rawls explicitly makes this his theory of justification. In, you know, for those Rawls Judean people, in his reply to Habermas, where Habermas says, why do you need this relation? Right? Habermas says, look, haven't you really done the job at A? Right? So why you bring C into the matter? To answer a question that almost any traditional philosopher is going to ask who's not part of this project, Rawls says, well, okay, it goes like this. A is what he calls a protanto justification. And this is on the handout, I think, at 12. It's a protanto justification, a freestanding justification, a justification as far as it goes. It's freestanding because it's the justification which is only based on shared interests. So it stands free from our metaphysical and our other commitments. Insofar as we share the interests, as far as these interests go, then these are the principles of justice which we affirm. But only as far as they go, because we don't know some important normative considerations. And what are those important normative considerations? C. So then Rawls says, full justification is achieved when each person looks at her own evaluative standards, metaphysical beliefs, religious views, and asks herself whether in the light of those she can affirm the conclusions of A. If she answers yes, A then is fully justified. If not, A is not justified. The Portanto justification, as Rawls says, can be overturned when a person adds up her values and says, no, given everything I care about, this doesn't do the trick for me. So this turns out to be something which is only justified insofar as we considered some reasons, but not all reasons. Here, we consider a person's full set of considerations, and then if that was true, we're done. We're not exactly clear why that's the case. Rawls tries to give examples where it's the case, and I'll talk a little bit more. Why should we assume that the C relation has turned from a hostile relation to a supportive relation? Interestingly, so I've just given the story of how insulation really not only is dropped from Rawls, but is rejected for something like the opposite relationship. Insulation becomes support. Shared reasons at the same time, or a little later, actually, takes a knocking. This gets very Rawls today, and I sometimes can't help it. In the 1993 preface to Political Liberalism, Rawls says, reasonable pluralism applies to conceptions of the good life and religious beliefs, but we can agree on the political conception, which is the typical liberal view. But as Rawls often did, rather than changing things, he just reinterprets them. So in his 1996 preface, he says, oh, but it also applies to the political. Duh. He says at 13, this is in the preface, in addition to conflicting comprehensive doctrines, that is your view of what's worthwhile in life, political liberalism does recognize that in any actual political society, a number of differing liberal political conceptions of justice compete with one another in society's political debate. This leads to another aim of political liberalism, saying how a well-ordered liberal society can be formulated given that not only reasonable pluralism of comprehensive conceptions, but one that applies to a family of reasonable liberal conceptions. So A is invaded by reasonable pluralism. What we've normally, early on, reasonable pluralism, use of human reason, led us to very different comprehensive doctrines, but up until 1993, it still led us to the same political doctrine. As Rawls's project, I think, actually gathers speed at the end of his life. That is, at the end of his life, he's rethinking more and more and throwing more stuff out that's now put together. As it's speeding up towards the end of his life, he just is not willing to say the disagreement on A anymore either. He has to admit that a lot of the same things that caused this disagreement is going to cause that disagreement. And so that's where Rawls leaves it. He leaves it that this is a set, not a principle. It's a set of different things. And he hopes that there are mutual supporting relations between the set and the comprehensive doctrines. And in some of the, you can see from some instructions to editor at the end of his life, he's still cooking things up all the time. I mean, he clearly thinks that he's revising the project in important ways. Parts are coming, things are being thrown out at the last moment. And then he gets ill, and that's pretty much it. So that's the end of Act 3, sort of the high point, and then in some sense the low point of this doctrine, at least insofar as Rawls thinks that the apex certainly was illusory. So now on to Act 4. The unfinished act. And one of Rawls's great contributions was bringing these problems back to the center of political philosophy. There's a certain tale about Rawls. And that tale is that until Rawls, there was only conceptual analysis. After Rawls, there was normative political philosophy. Well, first of all, the first part is entirely wrong. There's all sorts of normative political philosophy done before Rawls. But the second part is also wrong, is that Rawls didn't do strongly normative political philosophy in the sense of telling us what the normative truths are. What Rawls did is try to figure out how much normativity we can get given disagreement about normativity, which is a different question than what's real normativity. So he brought back this issue into, I think, the mainstream. That is, how can we get normative principles out of a world of normative disagreement? The project then continues, and there's like, I think of terms three branches of the project. One I don't want to say much about, and that is the people who say, Rawls got it all right at the end and just complete a project. I mean, there are such people, but I find this a view that strains credulity. I mean, it was quite clear that Rawls is thinking on the fly all the time. And the idea that this was a settled equilibrium where he got right there strikes me as probably not right. But I do know some Rawlsians, and if Rawls said it, that's the end of the story. And all we can do is interpret the text and worship. So we're leaving this side, okay, which I have my religious impulses, but not that one. So the other two, which I consider much more lively versions of this, of the project. Let me just paint neutral terms. Let's call one reactionary and one progressive, right? It's always important to be neutral, okay? So let me look at the reactionary view. Okay, the reactionary view is my good friend John Kuang, for example, and my friend Steve Macedo. And they more or less said, you know, wasn't it great when everyone was reading A Theory of Justice? And didn't it really go downhill with this political liberalism stuff? What if we could show that political liberalism really was a theory of justice and drag? So how do you do that? Well, John Kuang's view is like, well, first of all, get rid of this overlapping consensus stuff, right? Because this overlapping consensus stuff would say that C, which is illiberal, could be illiberal, can overturn the conclusions of liberalism. But that's illiberal to think that. So that's an illiberal thought you shouldn't have. So the first thing we'll do is say true liberals would never even think about C. So in order to get into the original position on Kuang's view, you have to sort of give a card saying, I'm a true liberal. And to be a true liberal has to say two things. I share these interests, and nothing could make me change my mind about them when I know my full conception of the good. That makes you a full liberal, and then we don't have to worry about Hobbes' problem, because Hobbes' problem has been bracketed out of the problem, right? To be a liberal is to see the results of the original position as definitive. And there's no possibility that other doctrines could override them. And this gives us sort of a stable liberal doctrine, but in some sense it just does now make liberalism a sectarian doctrine. And Kuang sort of admits that. John says, my theory is a theory of liberalism for liberals. I'm not trying to convince non-liberals to be liberals. I wouldn't be able to do that. I'm trying to convince liberals why they're liberals. And therefore why they're liberals is they think original position arguments are about right, and they would agree to original position stuff. A slightly more, essentially see what John's doing is positing insulation by saying, this is a little bit like the Lockean strategy. In order to be in the liberal settlement, you have to accept the insulation of your private views from the public views. If you don't accept insulation, like Roman Catholics under Locke, you just aren't part of the settlement. So, you know, although I make fun of John because he's a friend, it really is sort of trying to give the Lockean view in a more straightforward way that there's something that we require to be part of a liberal society, and that's to be accept the importance of insulating your private views from the public view. And if people don't do that, we can't have liberal societies, and Locke was right about that. So there's a sense in which, you know, despite teasing my friends, this is a sort of a way of taking Locke's understanding of the preconditions for a liberal society. And it does have some real attractions to it. However, in my thinking, we can't get rid, as you could tell from my talk, we can't get rid of the insulation worry that quickly. A problem with Locke, not a benefit of Locke, is that he seemed to presuppose you have to accept insulation to be part of a free society. Locke himself tried to justify it more. I think the glory of Rawls's work is he grappled with it in many ways, and he always insisted on getting the right answer. So then the question is, what do we do if he just take the political liberalism route and see how we can continue the Rawlsian unfinished project, how we can accept non-insulation, how we can accept the fact of disagreement and still go on with the project without simply assuming that people must just morally accept insulation as a requirement. Well, it would seem if we accept all of that, if we accept non-insulation, if we accept that shared reasons themselves are something subject to disagreement, why do we just end up back at the Hobbesian problem? What I want to suggest is that liberals can accept a of the Hobbesian, a one of the Hobbesian critique. That is, they can accept that our private reasoning does lead us to disagree on everything, including the political. So we can accept A1, and we certainly should accept B, because insulation has been proven very difficult to maintain. If the public reason liberal is to maintain the project in the face of all that, it has to be A2, which is the subjects of inquiry. Are these disagreements unbounded disagreements? This is what Rawls was thinking when he said a family of views. The family of views suggests that although we disagree about the ordering of political doctrines, that disagreement is not unbounded. In the terms of Sen, if good-willed people thinking about politics, Rawls wanted to argue they would agree to what Matra Sen calls a maximal set. A maximal set is a set of arrangements which they all believe are better than those outside the set, but they disagree about the ordering of those things inside the set. So everything in the set is better than that which is outside the set, but the people cannot agree how to order the things in the set. Right? That's a more rigorous notion of what a family is. So the important question for public reason liberals is there a maximal set which people knowing both A and C about themselves would a deliberative situation where people know A and C, would there be an interesting maximal set which would only include tolerant societies? That's the way, I think, to think of the Rawlsian project. And not to assert there is, because Rawls at the end just said, he actually sometimes called it a hope. Not just a hope there is, but to say, can we at least model the conditions under which some sets of A and C would agree to a reasonably liberal maximal set? This leads, I think, not only to some interesting problems in political philosophy, but to conclude, it leads us to rethink the tasks of moral theory. And to some extent, this is a feature of what we do in Arizona. I mean, I know everyone thinks Arizona is just about keeping hardworking Hispanics out of the state. But there's other things we do, too. We do other things as well. And one of the things that our PhD program sort of is known for is first is recognizing the importance of empirical work for normative work. Why is that the case? First of all, there's going to be a great deal of contingency in this way of doing political theory. We have to ask, given a set of people's actual normative beliefs and religious beliefs, let's understand those people. And can they come to an idealized maximal set? It won't be the case that all human beings will. There's certainly, every time I give a talk, I'm sure someone will today, it's what about Goebbels and what about the Nazis, right? So there's going to be the question of outliers. If we add some really, really bad people to the deliberative set who know they're really, really bad values, they won't be able to have a maximal set with others. So one thing is it's contingent about how wide of a group of people can actually accept the same framework and live under it, accepting its normative authority. It's not something which is an axiom. It's something to be investigated. My own belief is that it's much wider than many of my fellow political philosophers do think. One reason I believe that is that many of my fellow political philosophers are extraordinarily intelligent people who have extraordinarily narrow backgrounds. So they tend to think religious means crazy. So they'll say the religious person. And that is sort of undefined between a jihadist and a Quaker. In fact, if you look, for example, one of the really interesting things is that the strongest proponents of the American settlements are the evangelical Christians. Evangelical Christians are, first, the only problem they have is sometimes they think the United States is a little weak on separating the church and the state, but they're extraordinary, the surveys show they're extraordinary pro-constitutional, they're very pro the Bill of Rights. What we have to do is look at what people's real beliefs are. And not caricaturize beliefs in terms of sort of the undifferentiated other who's much more different than we are. So we have to actually look at people. And I sometimes, you know, try to look at different views that we might think are hostile and see to the extent they are. Rawls tried to do this in toy ways. And so I think what Rawls did in sort of toy ways, we have to actually sort of do in some more systematic ways. And we can ask, what sort of societies, what are the conditions for a society to achieve this sort of maximal set? And I think one of the reasons why Rawls can flip A and C upside down, the relation between conflict and support, was 300 years of cultural and value change, where liberalism became something which most people gave normative authority to in their comprehensive doctrines. Things had changed. And the Rawlsian view may well have been totally implausible in the 17th century, and in the 21st century, in some societies, much more plausible. The last thing, as Jacob mentioned in the introduction, this leads to a great deal of indeterminacy. Whatever that is. Indeterminacy. Political philosophy, if we're looking for the maximal sets, is not going to be able to give us what philosophers have always wanted. That is, the best, the optimal arrangement. What justice truly is. It's going to say things like, here are all these things we could live under. And Rawls at one point said, and I think a quote which people don't give enough credence to, we're searching for a framework we all can live with. It's not the framework we think is true, Rawls says explicitly. It's the framework that diverse people can all live with. And live with suggests, you know, it's not my best, but I can do it. If we think back to the public reason tradition, this idea that you can't live by your private judgment has always been essential to the public reason tradition. Hobbes, Locke, all believed, in Rawls, if you look at Outline of a Decision Procedure, you have your own views, but those aren't the views that you can live with on terms with your neighbors. So there's always been in the public reason tradition an idea that what you think is best and what you're going to live with aren't going to be the same thing. But this means when we do political philosophy, we're not going to be telling people this is just. We're going to be saying, here's a range of things that people can live with, and any of those might work for them, and maybe not be able to say more. I have found that both of these things are resisted by, you know, many of my colleagues, my other political philosophers, because they think the glory of political philosophy is it doesn't have anything to do with facts, and it tells you what to do. That's what makes it, that's what's so fun about it, right? You just sit back and tell other people what to do. And this suggests that we have to sort of be more modest in the aims of political philosophy. And rather than trying to figure out what to tell other people to do, we may try to model what different sorts of people can live with and how they can get along. Thank you very much.
Time for discussion, and it is our custom at these events to reserve the first question to one of the undergraduates in the Research Group on Constitutional Studies Student Fellowship. After the first question, I'll leave you to call on your own people. But MA students in our student fellowship.
Is there anybody who's not retired?
Okay. It's not a very serious question. You gave this example of the reasoning Rawls provided between toy reasoning versus more systematic, and I wasn't clear about what you meant by that. What does toy reasoning signify?
Well, Rawls says a utilitarian can accept the principles, and a Kantian can accept the principles. And they're both sort of like one paragraph understandings of what the role, what the utilitarian and what the Kantian could do, right? So I think what we have to do, for example, we might have to sort of look at the commitments of different religious views and distinguish things like evangelicals from fundamentalists and some fundamentalists from others and try to get a more fine-tuned handle on what the religious views are and then try to understand questions like this. If we add this other view to the deliberative situation, what does it do to the maximal set? What does it do to the result? Does it change it? Does it constrict it? Does it not? So each of those will actually be investigations about how far we can expand the set of people in it to what sorts of people and still get a society where all can accept the same rules. Rawls still had the idea that we know what the right answer is. We want to see who can get to it. But the question isn't, we know what the derivation from A is. Because remember, I said, and this is somewhat different than Rawls, we want to know A and C together and see what its results are. Rawls had a two-step and then see whether C confirms the result. So for Rawls, the question was, I knew what the right answer was, and so my toy example was just to see whether the quintessential utilitarian could accept it. The way I think we should do it is we should imagine deliberative situations of increasing complexity. And when we have a moral problem, we say, okay, let's understand this person's overall moral view as well as we can. Now put them into the deliberative situation. Does it change our results a lot? Or does it change them at all? But it can't be that we know the answer and just see whether they want to sign on to it. What we want to do is see whether it changes the answer. And that, I think, is a significantly important difference. But I do think it requires a lot more sensitivity about what, especially different religious views are. That's all I meant.
Here are you, I didn't call.
Oh, I can't see, so maybe you can.
I
just see a light.
Okay. Hi. That was great. So I have tons of questions, but I'm just going to ask one. And it kind of straddles the border between Rawls-Schmidian and substantive, but I'm going to try to bring up a substantive thing. It seems to me that one of the issues where Rawls, unless there was stuff that I haven't seen, never really knew what it was, is the importance that he ascribed to consensus. So the one thing that is stable between Rawls 1 and Rawls 2 is the fact that it's not an overlapping compromise, it's an overlapping consensus. And that was because he had a really serious concern with modus vivendi versus, he had stability concerns. So he thought that compromise, modus vivendi, would not lead to something sufficiently stable. And so, one of the things that, it could be that at the end of the day, this is just another way of talking about the indeterminacy that you talked about, but one of the agendas that I think we need to bring up to the table is basically a kind of political philosophy of compromise, and sort of get over the sort of consensus hangover, which I think has been a legacy both of Rawls 1 and Rawls 2, although framed in different ways. So that phrase, how can we all get along, was, I think, sort of something that he said, but then when you look at the official architecture of the theory, both in both iterations of the theory, you get this concern about stability, bringing it back into the area of consensus. And that, I think that's one of the areas where political philosophy has to really break away.
Okay, that's really cool. Let me just try to explore that. Let's just try to get a handle on consensus, compromise, modus vivendi, okay? So, as you were talking, I'm afraid I thought of a 2x2 table, which is always shows that you're in trouble, right? But first of all, we can ask whether the basis is just self-interests. That is, whether we're just sort of considering, does it benefit me in some narrow way? And the other thing we can think of is the person drawing on their normative commitments. Okay. Now, what's the compromise versus consensus view? For example, Rawls says, the doctrines might cohere with, conflict with, or not conflict too much with A. Right? So there's all, the general coherence argument is laid aside where it just was all for it. And now there's just some sort of relation where, you know, some people really like it, some people won't like it, some people won't like it very much, but enough. So how would you, I wasn't clear on the distinction here between the consensus and compromise. So how would we, what's the, how would you just think the difference is going?
Is that actually, should I go back?
Oh. Seems, I'm sorry, we're being Socratic here.
Yeah. So I think that, that, you know, the bottom, the sort of bottom right-hand question, it was sort of, Rawls had a blind spot about that. So, you know, one of the things that I, when you were talking about B getting fed back into A, I was surprised that you didn't talk a little bit about the way that B got fed into C. In other words, that there was this kind of, you know, threatening sort of vicious circularity in his insulation of reasonable from unreasonable conceptions of a good, where it turns out, unfortunately, that the distinction is pretty much, you know, you're reasonable if you're willing to play ball with A. Right? And unreasonable, we don't have to worry about you. What we then end up doing is just treating you like weather. You know, we just make sure that we have, we batten down the hatches. And, you know, I've always found that that was, you know, that the B into C thing was a problem. And so, you know, those three attitudes that you describe, you know, I think this is, A is really just a full emanation of my preferred theory. You know, I don't think that he really was able to contemplate the perspective of someone who says, I think this is really not very good, but I could live with it, because, you know, war is worse, or something like that. So that's kind of sketchy.
Yeah, okay.
But, you know, I don't think that he really had a way of thinking about the bottom right, because of this reasonable.
Okay, that's really interesting. I kind of think a lot of it is about the bottom right. Yeah. I think he definitely didn't want us to rely too much on self-interest.
Yeah.
You know, peace, just because it's going to benefit me. So he didn't like stability. He thought that maybe have real problems with stability. But I guess I think he did. I think Rawls thought, maybe I'm reading too much of me into Rawls, that public life is a normative compromise. It's a normative compromise between what we would like and what we can accept. But that's a little Rawls today. But let's accept, I think you and I agree, that that's really an important area. And it's important not to confuse that with compromise just based on self-interest. That is, we ask, what's my normative, what do I care about in life? And does the way that we publicly relate to each other sufficiently cohere with that I can still see it as normative? And that's the important thing. If it's sometimes I talk in game theory terms, if it's just self-interest, it can only be a descriptive convention. I can say, look, my interest is to do this as long as you do it. But it doesn't have any normative pull on me because I'm only doing it because it's in my interest. And that's what my friend Christina Bicchiari calls a descriptive convention. They're important, but I don't feel guilty when I violate a descriptive convention. I don't feel that I should hold other people accountable. But if it's based on normative criteria, that is, I actually see this as normatively acceptable, then when I violate it, I feel guilty. I expect other people to hold up to it. I have normative expectations. So I think the important thing to make the story work is that what Rawls called in the mid-70s the moral constitution that we agree to, we all can see as normative. So live with now means normatively live with, because if we don't see it as normative, it doesn't provide the basis for those sorts of normative relations we want to keep going. So I agree, but that's why I think especially that self-interest won't do it, because even if it all is in our interest, like some people think of modus vivendi, that can't be the basis for normative relations between us.
Jake. Thank you very much. So it seems to me that you said, and it makes sense, that Rawls gets to say, ultimately, that C is going to support A, because from roughly the time Hobbes and Locke were writing, you have something like the liberalization of a lot of religious groups that, you know, when Locke wrote, said just couldn't be part of it. So what at the end of, you know, so we have a broadening of the people who can sort of fit into liberalism, because it seems like liberalism is gaining speed. Does this part two of the post-Rawlsian project have anything to say to the people who still can't be liberal, other than more or less what Locke says, that we can't trust Catholics and atheists?
Okay, just what do we mean by can't be liberal? Just give me a gloss on that.
So the people who, for metaphysical reasons, can't buy it.
Okay, but I just wanted to push a little more substantive. Does it mean that they can't buy into a tolerant society, for example, right? I mean, that's going to be...
Sure.
Okay, so there's a lot of... Here's one of the things. I think your quintessential liberal may have to start giving things up to actually have a society that people endorse. That is, liberals have this nice big package of stuff they want. Some of it's tolerance, and some of it's the difference principle, and some of it's, you know, affirmative action, and some of it's all this stuff they want. And the Kuang view is really nice because they can say, okay, imagine all the people who want this get together. They'll agree to it, won't they? And sure enough, so I've justified it. It worked really quickly and it was nice. Now maybe we say, well, let's try to maximize the society where people can understand a framework of social cooperation that is normative. Now, I agree, there's some point in which someone says, I cannot see any framework of social cooperation with these other people. I cannot live with them. That's got to be a theoretical possibility. But the way we put that theoretical possibility off is beginning with less robust norms. And we might have all series of different norms. So when we buy into liberalism, the first thing is, can you buy into harm rules? Turns out, every society buys into harm rules. Insofar as John Stuart Mill is a harm principle guy, one thing that everyone can buy into is harm rules. We don't find a society without them anywhere. Okay, so the next thing is, you know, can you buy into some other rules? For example, rules about not forcing people to go to... What we do, rather than saying, here's liberalism, can it be justified, I believe it's an iterative process. Here's a basic rule of social life. Can we do that? Let's see if there's another rule of social life. Can we do that? As we get more specific rules, we'll find that the realm of people who agree to those rules will be less, and we have a moral problem what to do with that. But I think we'll find that that question of who's in and who's out turns out to be a more interesting question, like, if morality requires this, why won't this sort of group people be able to see it as normative? And I believe at the foundations, one of my views in looking at stuff, a lot of these rules are extraordinarily robust interculturally. I just wrote a paper on hunter-gatherer societies, right? Because I'm thinking, we want to know these things. Right? Well, it turns out hunter-gatherer societies are incredibly devoted to maintaining personal autonomy against bullies. Right? If you want to understand, what is hunter-gatherer societies about? It's about controlling the damn alpha males so everyone else can have their own lives, right? Well, you know, this is not sort of a particularly idiosyncratic problem. And I think this actually might be a problem that is central to human organization. So I guess I'm going to say, if we take it a little bit at a time, we find that there's a fairly robust, non-sectarian system of norms, and then we'll find out when we're getting more sectarian. We'll find out, you know, everyone can go here, but now we're up to here. We lose this whole group. And we might ask why. We might ask, don't we need their cooperation? But we'll have to ask that question, but I don't think it's just an on-off question. It's an incremental question. And I think these norms are really much more robust than maybe philosophers think. Like I said, a lot of these norms, you just can't find societies that don't have them. Often you're opposing, we're rejecting norms that say you can impose, which is slightly different than trying to impose norms.
Can I just follow up very briefly? I think not.
I enjoyed that very much, especially the big picture and some of the conclusions at the end. But Lenin draws from C to support A. Of course, he does it very selectively. And non-Rawlsians get really alarmed at the phrase, you know, a reasonable comprehensive doctrine, in whose eyes. And of course, the point is, raised earlier, we can agree about anything. Can we at least introduce clarity? And my own feeling is that Rawls would accept this, even if he didn't express it quite this way. If we bring B back into the picture again, not as a thin theory of the good, but something weaker or thinner, but nevertheless strong, i.e. the status of the persons who are involved in any conceivable schemes of social cooperation. We have claims on one another, basic reasons of vulnerability and so forth. We need cooperation. And to deny anyone that status is to deny them the standing of a person in the moral sense. Now, it seems to me that gives you a kind of test We can agree on all sorts of other things, and if we only agreed on that, we couldn't do anything. But that would have given us a reason for saying, this I cannot live with. That I must countenance, even though actually it isn't really to my taste.
Yeah, I think what you've done there is say we've moved from Rawls' notion of the reasonable to Rawls' notion of the decent. Because he says, you know, we just can't imagine a society that is not really an order. He says that's not a cooperative order at all, if you don't admit these things. So I think you're right. I mean, like anyone, I think Rawls just packed a lot of stuff into the reasonable he wanted, and it was insulting because a lot of people who are good liberals were called unreasonable, right? And I always thought I was a reasonable person. You know, I did all these good, and now I'm unreasonable. And it was gratuitously insulting, and it was just floundering around at the end. But I think you're right. The notion of the decent, which Rawls ties to, we just can't imagine a society that doesn't meet these criteria of being a cooperative social order at all. And I think that's what you're building on. That's what he was getting to at the end when his theory of human rights was trying to get something like that. I think that's exactly right.
We got one more question from a student. Yes, Rob.
Very vague question. Would you say that Rawls went from being an ideal theorist to being an unideal theorist?
That's a really hard question, but what we mean by ideal and non-ideal. I think there's one sense in which Rawls always is an ideal theorist. As Paul Weissman points out, Rawls always has to assume that these things would work under perfect compliance because that's the stability test. That he doesn't want to say, well, here's the rules, but only if the state enforces them, because that wouldn't show you got the internal stability that the rules really appeal to people's own overall views. So insofar as we mean by ideal theory, we assume perfect compliance. That, I think, is part of this project. We show that there's going to be something like self-generated compliance. The other question is whether or not we should assume conditions that are reasonable utopian conditions. That, I think Rawls still believed he was talking about reasonable utopian conditions, and so overlapping consensus would be a liberalism under the best possible conditions that could maintain itself. So I think perfect compliance can't be dropped out. I think the reasonable utopia can be moderated at all different levels about how stringent we want our conditions for success to be. I don't know if that's helpful. But I think the perfect compliance stuff is necessary, because if we're only depending on the state to force us to comply, we don't know whether the compliance is coming from our own normative frameworks or acting in self-interest.
All right. The indication of the importance of looking at empirical questions provides a nice bridge to the next lecture in the series, in which Naomi Lamoureux from Yale will speak on organizational history and civil society with an examination of the real organizational forms and their development that have made possible the organizations of civil society within liberal democracies.